totally different attitudes toward life, which were reflected in their jiu-jitsu. There was never any question that Holes was the best of our generation. Naturally, this was the hardest on Horion. Not only did he want to be the family champion and the ambassador of Gracie Jiu-Jitsu, but our dad also wanted him to be the champ, which added even more pressure. In theory, Horion was perfect. He had perfect technique, a perfect physique, and a perfect mindset. But even with my dad barking instructions at him like a corner man, Holes whipped him every time. After he lost, Dad could not mask his disappointment. He'd say, "Good job, Holes," and then berate Horion for his mistakes. It was sometimes hard to watch, because they both gave everything they had. Holes was just better. I think this is why Horion gravitated to the business side of jiu-jitsu. My dad believed that suffering was part of the growth process, and we were programmed to believe that this theory was normal. We trained so hard in the academy that tournaments seemed easy. Elio believed that the harder you trained, the easier you fought. We learned at a very young age that there was no point in chickening out, because it wouldn't get you out of anything. My dad would simply say, "Get back out there and do it again." You also realized that if you followed the Gracie protocols on training, diet, and fighting, they worked. Even my younger brother, Hoyce, who is a very mellow guy, got pushed hard in training and understood commitment and suffering at a very young age. There was always some drama in Teresópolis because we were all stretching ourselves to the limit. You either won or you lost, and all of your brothers and cousins saw it. Some rose to the challenge, others collapsed under the weight of it. My first jiu-jitsu rival was a cousin who was a year older, but about my same size. Even though he was really competitive, I beat him regularly. One day he said to me, "You only beat me because we were wearing gis. Now you're not, and I can beat you." I smacked him, we started to fight, and I waited for him to get mad, because when he got mad, he bit his thumb, kept it in his mouth, and fought one-handed. This was his fatal flaw as a fighter. Sure enough, my cousin got mad and started biting his thumb. So I controlled him with one hand and punched him with the other. There were rivalries between Uncle Carlos's sons and Elio's sons, but Holes helped to mitigate these. Because he was Carlos's son, who was raised by my dad, and was the best fighter of our generation, Holes brought the two sides of the family together. And since my brothers and I lived in Rio and were in the academy every day, we had an advantage over our cousins who grew up in Teresópolis. Some of my cousins thought Elio was too harsh and training with him was too tough. My dad never tolerated excuses and often told people things that they did not want to hear about themselves. I think he treated his children and nephews the same. Holes, after all, was really his nephew. He definitely favored his biological son, Horion, but once it was undeniable that Holes was the better fighter, Elio offered no excuses and accepted the truth. If nothing else, my dad was a realist. Our hierarchy was a brutally honest one, but we also learned to admit when we were wrong. If you told on your brother, Elio would say, "I don't care who did what. If you both believe that you are right, I'll mediate a solution. But if one of you is lying, your punishment will be harsh because you knew what you did was wrong." His approach ensured that we policed ourselves and realized it was best to solve our problems without getting Dad involved. When Elio realized how good and how passionate I was about jiu-jitsu, we developed a special relationship. My dad recognized something in me and encouraged me to become the greatest Gracie. He never had to push me the way he had to push some of the others. In addition to jiu-jitsu, my father and I also shared a great passion for animals. He and Uncle Carlos treated animals like people. They did not try to tame them as much as they made friends with them. My uncle liked to sunbathe naked on top of the water tower, and he befriended two wild hawks in Teresópolis. My dad liked to adopt the meanest dogs he could find, the ones that bit everyone, and then turn them into his pets. It was yet another test for him. I don't know if it was patience or mind control, but nobody was better with dogs than my father. He believed that the strength of his mind allowed him to connect with even the most vicious animals of any species. His friend owned a crazy Doberman that bit everyone, so my dad started going by his house just to visit the dog. They got so close that when Elio left, the Doberman would cry until my dad came back the next time to see him. Finally, the dog's owner said, "Elio, I'm giving you the dog because the only time he's happy is when you're around." Soon, my dad had a kennel full of Doberman pinschers. João, another one of my dad's friends, bred Filas, Mastiffs. These gigantic, aggressive dogs weigh over 100 pounds and were once used to hunt big game and runaway slaves in Brazil. He had one really mean dog called Buma, who at the age of 6 months attacked João, so he gave him to my dad. João put a leash on the dog, and he, my dad, and Buma drove up to our ranch. When they arrived, Elio took him out of the car by the leash and did not let go of that leash for the whole weekend. My dad finally took Buma off it, and the dog was in love with him. That dog became good with kids and was loved by the whole family. Next, he got a German shepherd named Thor, who became my first dog. Elio also liked horses and mules, especially the ones that kicked apart their corrals, the ones that the toughest Brazilian cowboys thought were crazy. When I was 10, my dad gave me a mare I named Lauren, who was my first love. In the late 1960s, my father bought a 50-acre ranch of his own in a beautiful valley in Petrópolis. He called it Nosso Vale, our valley. I spent my days there cleaning and grooming Lauren. I was the first person to mount her and was eventually able to ride her bareback without a bridle. Using only my legs, I could command her to speed up, slow down, stop, turn right, left. There was a real synchronicity between us. I'd feed her carrots, and she would kiss me and follow me around without a lead rope. If I put a child on her back, she knew to be gentle. My dad's horse, Mustang, was a Paso Fino stallion that looked like Roy Rogers' horse, Trigger. He lived in a grassy field with Lauren and the other mares. One day, my dad told me to bring Mustang down from the top of the pasture. I put a lead rope around his neck and started to bring him down the hill, but he began to drag me, so I stopped and mounted him. Mustang saw that someone had left the corral open. He ran right onto the dirt road and began to gallop toward the highway. My dad saw the disaster that was unfolding and screamed, "Hold on!" just before we vanished over the hill. I grabbed the stallion's mane as he galloped downhill. Mustang was not stupid. As he got closer to the highway, he slowed down enough for me to jump off. I landed on my feet, grabbed the lead rope, regained control of the horse, and calmed him. Then I remounted him and started to ride back to the ranch. Just as we crested the hill, I saw my dad running toward us. When he saw me and Mustang calmly riding back to the ranch, he screamed, "Yes!" and the fear in his eyes turned to pride. The connection we made that day was a real victory for me, because I had proved to Elio that his confidence in me was not misplaced, and my dad was never scared for me again. If anything, he was overconfident in me and gave me a great deal of freedom that I made the most of. I was by myself a lot because I was so much younger than my brothers. I never needed people around me to feel comfortable, and I was extremely curious about the world. When I rode my bike through Copacabana, Thor would run next to me. If I rode in the street, he would follow me on the sidewalk. If I crossed a street, he'd wait on the curb until I said, "Go," and then he'd sprint through traffic jams and busy streets. It didn't matter to him. If I went somewhere in a car with my friends, I'd leave my bike on the sidewalk and say, "Sit right there." Thor would wait for hours. Rio is like New York City and Bangkok combined. It is a turbulent, whatever-you-want-whenever-you-want-it mix of sex, crime, drugs, nature, and beach culture. Although we lived in a nice apartment in Copacabana, Rio is not like L.A. There is not a rich town like Beverly Hills and then a poor one like Compton. They are combined. One minute you're in Beverly Hills, and the next you turn down a side street and are in Compton. As a kid, I developed street smarts. At every stoplight, there is a group of guys who are that block's eyes and ears. Some sell drinks, some sell candy, and some sell drugs. If a car stops, they approach the driver's window, and if the driver just stares ahead like they don't exist, he might get a rock through the window and lose his wallet. From the gangbangers to the fighters to the high society matrons to the surfers to the most beautiful girls in Ipanema, I wanted to understand all of it. I would often ditch school and just walk around Rio. I had normal rounds that I made through the city. First, I would visit the appliance store and joke around with a salesman. "You want to buy a refrigerator, kid?" he'd ask. "Not today, but maybe tomorrow." Then I would go to the bakery, buy a snack, and talk with the baker. Next, it was off to the newsstand to talk to the guy who sold papers about the recent soccer matches. Everyone knew that I was supposed to be in school because I was still wearing my uniform and carrying my books. I guess I provided some relief from their daily grinds. Many of the upper-class kids seemed dumb to me because they had no street smarts. I didn't want to be a sheltered kid who knew nothing about real life and lived inside of a comfortable bubble. Sometimes my mom's rich friends would come over to our house with their sons who were around my age, and it was difficult for me to relate to them because I grew up with much older brothers. They'd want to talk about the new Walt Disney movie, and I'd want to talk about the latest issue of Playboy or the new Led Zeppelin album. After they left, my mom would ask, "Did you like little Jose?" "He was a spoiled little shit." "Why don't you like him?" "He's not smart, Mom. He doesn't know anything about anything." I was beginning to understand that money and social position define some people, but I wanted to be defined by my merit. Brazil's population comes from all over the world. There are European Brazilians, African Brazilians, Japanese Brazilians, Indian African Brazilians, and just about any other racial and ethnic combination you can imagine. Class, on the other hand, was a different matter, because the rich didn't mix with the poor. My grandfather was a wealthy man who owned a department store and a great deal of real estate. My mother, Margarida, was very well-traveled, spoke French, and was a member of Rio's high society. Her father was not happy when she fell madly in love with a fighter, whom he considered beneath his daughter's social status. I learned about class the hard way. One day when I was 7 or 8, I went down to the beach by myself and started playing with a kid from the favela who was also alone. We were digging tunnels in the sand and having a lot of fun together. A couple of hours later, I brought the boy back to our apartment for lunch. When we walked in, my mother looked at the kid and asked, "Why'd you bring him here?" "He's my friend, Mom. We came to eat, and then we're going back to the beach to play some more." My mother made us lunch, but I felt that I had done something wrong. I was surprised by both my mom's fearful reaction and the fact that she doubted my judgment. It was very uncomfortable, so when I came home later, I asked her what was wrong, and she said, "That boy is so poor, you shouldn't play with him. He might come here one day and steal your things." This particular kid was smart, courageous, tough, someone I felt very aligned with. I thought to myself, my mother is trying to forbid me from being friends with him just because he is poor. The message that I took away from that experience was probably the opposite of the one that my mother was trying to send. I disagreed strongly with the idea that I should judge people by their appearance or social status. Instead, I decided to follow my heart. Money can't buy the most important things in life: friendship, loyalty, courage, honesty, happiness, intelligence. Anyone from any class, race, or station in life may or may not have these attributes. If I felt power, love, respect, intelligence, I was going to engage with an open heart and be willing to accept that person as a brother or sister. If anything, my mom's attitude made the streets seem even more attractive. The kids were smarter, they didn't get ripped off, and they knew how to take care of themselves because they were more experienced. At 13, I decided to stop going to school because it seemed pointless to me. I loved jiu-jitsu and surfing and knew that I was going to be a fighter. What did I need school for? I told my dad that I was dropping out of school, and he wisely said, "You are still my son. I will feed you, but don't bother me for anything else. No new bicycles or presents. From now on, you have to make your own money." The first cash I ever made was from helping Horyun teach jiu-jitsu. Soon I found more lucrative hustles than working for my brother. While I am not proud of my flirtation with the criminal lifestyle, I think it is important that I acknowledge it. My experiences on the streets of Rio were priceless and helped to shape me. They allowed me to taste forbidden fruits and to enter worlds I never would have otherwise. Today I try to lead by example and do not advocate using illegal drugs or many legal ones. There are too many people searching for pharmaceutical solutions to basic human problems. Temporary depression is a natural human reaction to the loss of a loved one or other misfortunes in life. How can a pill change something like that? Today, if a child has trouble concentrating in school, his parents don't take away his iPhone, iPad, and computer and make him play outside. Instead, they go to a psychiatrist who prescribes medication for his condition. Illegal drugs like black market fentanyl, as well as prescription opiates, are so powerful and addictive that to take them is to gamble with your life. While I am not proud to expose this part of my history, I have to be honest. If I hadn't had these experiences, I would be a very different person. I made myself examine and try to understand everything I was curious about. I sought out new and extreme experiences. I knew that I could get hurt, but I decided the risk was worth it. I know many excellent jiu-jitsu fighters whose minds are not open because they are scared and threatened by ideas and lifestyles they do not understand. The first thing they do is judge, often without any basis. I try not to be judgmental, but to accept things as they are, not how I would like them to be. Even though I had helped my father try to pull Helson from the hole of drug addiction, part of me also wanted to see what lurked inside that hole. I was 14 when I fell in with a gang of teenagers who lived in an apartment complex where my Uncle Carlos had an apartment. We called ourselves Camoes, after the housing project where most of them lived. There were 30 or 40 of us, between the ages of 14 and 20. We were an army of streetwise kids who were trying to capitalize on anything and everything we could. We didn't care if you were rich or poor. If you were in sync with us mentally, physically, and emotionally, you were our brother. The only way that you could become part of our group was by your individual merit. Some of the smartest, most courageous people I've ever met were in that gang. I knew they would back me, win or lose, right or wrong, no matter what. Given that toughness, loyalty, and courage were the values my family held sacred, I wanted to be around people who shared those values. Initially, I was one of the youngest kids, but the older guys liked me because I made myself useful. There was a handful of rich guys in our gang, but the majority were middle and lower class. If you said, "Let's go to the restaurant and eat filet mignon," only one guy would go with you. But if you said, "Let's go rob the popcorn stand," everyone would go. Camoes had a beach soccer team. Beasal, or beach soccer, was invented in Rio during the 1950s. It's just like regular soccer, except that there are only 5 players per side, and the field is just 40 yards long. When I was growing up, there were 5 or 6 teams that represented different Copacabana neighborhoods. The competition was fierce, and hundreds of people would turn out for the big tournaments. The Camoes guys used to like to stand behind our rival's goal and try to distract their goalie by yelling insults at him. There was always tension at those games, and afterward it would usually explode with a few fights and lots of chaos and commotion. One time we went to Urca, where Camoes was playing. After a referee's disputed call, one of the leaders of Camoes started fighting with a fan from the rival team. Very quickly we were outnumbered, almost surrounded, and had to run for our lives back to Copacabana with 100 of the other team's supporters on our heels. We would stop and fight a little bit and then keep running. These fights were not personal. It was more like team against team. Somebody might occasionally throw a bottle, but there were never any guns like today. Very quickly, I proved myself brave and reliable and began to move up the Kamoi's food chain. First, I worked as a lookout and messenger for a pot dealer named Cleo. When it got dark, he would go down to the beach and stand near the ocean, because there he could see everyone, but nobody could see him. Next, I started making deliveries and selling pot myself. Because I lived a half hour away in a more upper-middle-class area, I became the airplane that dropped weed into my neighborhood. One day a friend wanted to buy a small bag. I was in a rush, so I took a handful of pot out of a much bigger one-pound bag. Instead of putting the pound bag in its hiding place, I put it under the pillow on my bed and ran out of the house. When I got home, the bag of weed was gone, and I knew I was in deep shit. I was more afraid of Cleo than my mom, so I asked her for my pot back. "I don't want to talk to you. I'm going to show it to your dad," she said. Then Horion came home, and he tried to interrogate me, but I refused to talk to anyone but my dad. When Elio finally got home, he and Horion started flushing the pot down the toilet. I begged them not to do it, because the weed was not mine. The second the words left my lips, I knew I had made a mistake. Now all eyes were on me. My dad now wanted to know who was fronting a pound of pot to a 14-year-old. Worse, Elio wanted me to take him to talk to Cleo the next night. "I'm not going to arrest him or beat him up," my dad promised. "I'm just going to tell him to stay away from you." The next night, we went to the beach, and I approached Cleo with my dad and Horion. "Cleo, my dad wants to..." Elio cut me off. "Hey, motherfucker, if you ever..." The dealer tried to run for it, but Horion tackled him and held him down as my dad lectured him menacingly. He begged for forgiveness and was totally humiliated. The next morning I felt horrible, so I went to see Cleo. I offered to work off the pot and promised that it would never happen again. He forgave me. Even though I went back into business for a little while longer, I began to drift away from Kamois when members started stealing stereos and using guns. I knew they were on a path that would take them nowhere fast, and I was much more interested in jiu-jitsu, surfing, and girls than a life of crime. Although I was rebellious and did things that my dad didn't agree with, I never stopped competing and never stopped winning. In his eyes, this made me special. It was about this time that I began to train with my brother, Holes. Up to this point, Elio was my only teacher. Whether he was surfing, training, fighting, riding horses, hang gliding, or chasing girls, Holes was constantly in motion. He was fast, technical, and always pushed me to train harder and achieve more. Initially, he was teaching with my father and Horion downtown. Then Holes started teaching 3 days a week at my cousin Carlson's school in Copacabana. After he retired as family champion, Carlson was the first member of the second generation of Gracies to break with my father. He opened his own school in 1964 and, unlike Elio, taught group classes and even allowed students to train for free as long as they were good fighters and willing to carry the Gracie flag into battle. Carlson's generosity is legendary, which explains the loyalty and gratitude that so many fighters have for him even today. My cousin's academy was the opposite of my father's. It was filthy. Everyone wore dirty gis, and when you walked in, you got intimidated by the smell alone. Carlson's students were aggressive, but relied too much on strength. His techniques weren't the most polished, but they fit with the kind of students he had. My cousin's teaching style was also brutal. When my dad was coaching a student, he would say, "Okay, stay calm, maintain your base, and work your escape." In the same situation, Carlson would have screamed at the student, "Get your fucking head out of there and smash that motherfucker." To him, Gracie Jiu-Jitsu wasn't about the triumph of brains over brawn, or precise technique, or the family diet. It was all about fighting until your heart came out of your mouth. If you could survive training in that environment, tournaments were just another day at the office. I started to go to Carlson's Academy in Copacabana to train because there were more students my age. The downtown academy was mostly businessmen taking private lessons, and therefore the training was much softer. My cousin's school was the opposite. It was packed with tough young guys who wanted to become fighters. It was a much more intense and dynamic environment. You never knew who might show up to train with Holes, because he was also training in judo, sambo, and wrestling. Holes wanted to establish a Brazilian national wrestling team to compete internationally. This irritated the officials of Brazil's official wrestling governing body, who considered us upstarts who were trying to encroach on their turf. In 1978, FILA, Federación Internacional de Lutte Associée, or International Federation of Associated Wrestling Styles, now named United World Wrestling, the world's governing body for wrestling, sent American wrestler Bob Anderson to Rio to coach the Brazilian wrestlers who were Holes's rivals. Anderson was a big and extremely skilled Greco-Roman freestyle and sambo champion from Southern California, who was also a good surfer. When Bob Anderson arrived in Rio, nobody from the official wrestling organization came to pick him up at the airport. Someone who knew Holes saw the giant, muscular American, who looked like the Incredible Hulk, waiting with his surfboard at the airport, and struck up a conversation with him. Somehow, word reached Holes that an American wrestling champion was stranded at the airport. By the time he and my cousin Carlson showed up at the airport, Anderson had been waiting for hours. According to legend, Holes apologized for being late, told Anderson they were the Brazilian wrestling officials, put his board on the roof of the car, and off they went. For the next week, Anderson and Holes lived, trained, and surfed together. Bob even got to go to a Brazil versus Argentina soccer game. Rio with Holes was another level of fun and constant activity. By the time the American wrestler realized that he had been kidnapped by my brother, he didn't want to leave. But it wasn't all fun and games. Anderson and Holes trained hard and compared and dissected each other's techniques. The wrestler thought it was strange that Holes always wore a gi, but he was having so much fun that he didn't ask too many questions. What impressed the American most was Holes's ability to work out of any position. He would later call Holes a Renaissance man who took elements from other martial arts, even other sports, and applied them to jiu-jitsu. Bob Anderson helped Holes modify a wrestling hold called a key lock, which Holes renamed the Americana in his honor. Today it is a popular jiu-jitsu submission. Just before Anderson left to go home, he and Holes had a match. They went back and forth for a long time before Holes caught him in a heel hook. Bob Anderson was a gracious guest who really connected with Holes and the Gracie family. Training with Holes was essentially fighting. He reinforced what Elio had already taught me. Fuck points, fuck judges, win by submission or not at all. I began to improve quickly under Holes, and Elio was not surprised. I wasn't stubborn and never choked under pressure. Now the expectations for me were from both Holes and my dad, and they were extremely high. My dad was never euphoric after my victories. He expected me to win. Now he needed me, because I was always ready to fight challengers to prove that his jiu-jitsu was the best. Elio loved to take me to my cousin Carlson's academy. "You think your jiu-jitsu is better than mine?" he'd say to Carlson. "My kid can beat your best guys." Carlson Gracie was a warm-hearted guy, but he was also super competitive. It didn't matter if it was a cockfight, a poker game, or a vale tudo match. He was most comfortable in the center of turmoil and chaos. He used to piss everyone off at tournaments because he would scream at the referees and totally intimidate them. The biggest rivalry at that time was between Carlson and Holes. At tournaments, we could have only two athletes fight in each belt and weight division. The qualifying tournaments between Holes's students, Carlson's students, and Horion's students to see who was going to represent us were always more competitive than the actual tournaments. Eventually, we separated the schools. Holes and Horion's students would represent the Gracie Academy, and Carlson's students would represent the Carlson Gracie Academy. By the time Father awarded me my purple belt at 16, I was getting good at spotting my opponent's flaws and capitalizing on them. I had many tough matches, but I always won. and was really starting to feel my power. One day, a friend and student took me to the Luta Livre Academy at Boqueirão for some no-gi training. There were about 20 guys there, and they had no idea who I was. My friend just told the teacher, "I brought a friend to spar with us. He has a background in jiu-jitsu." The teacher said, "No problem." Pointed to one of the biggest guys in the room and said to me, "Spar with him." After I beat the big guy easily, he said, "Now spar with him," and pointed to another big guy. In less than an hour, I had submitted everyone in the class but the teacher. We had a match, and after I submitted him, it was a bit awkward until my friend said, "You've got nothing to be ashamed of. That's Elio Gracie's son, Hickson." "Well, fuck, that explains it," the teacher said. "I have a lot of respect for your dad. Come back anytime." While I liked grappling and jiu-jitsu competitions, I was already thinking about my first Vale Tudo fight. Today it is possible to get a jiu-jitsu black belt without knowing self-defense or even getting into a real fight. This was impossible during the 1970s and 1980s. Because my father and uncle loudly proclaimed their style the world's most effective form of self-defense, every young Gracie knew that at some point he would be called upon to represent our family in the ring or in the street. Your first official Vale Tudo fight was like losing your virginity. It was a rite of passage. Chapter 3. Predators and Prey. As I began to understand how transformative jiu-jitsu was, I fell in love with teaching and my ability to change people and their behavior from within. It was much more than teaching jiu-jitsu. It was also adding something to someone's life. My father taught me that if you want to be a great instructor, you need to think of jiu-jitsu not only as techniques to be taught, but as a psychological education as well. In addition to fighting, students learn how to better sense danger, the difference between patience and passivity, and how losing is not the same thing as being defeated. First, you have to understand your students as people. If they're too excitable, mellow them out. If they're too mellow, light a fire under their ass. If they're passive, make them more aggressive. My dad and Horion taught me how to teach the entire person, including the psyche, and not just the fighter. When I put physical pressure on students, I see their true personalities because they immediately show me things that they are able to hide when they're not on the mat, their state of emotional balance or ability to manage pressure, for example. Once I have this information, I use it to tailor a curriculum to the students' needs that will benefit each of them in a profound way. I don't make them examine just how they fight, but also how they feel when they fight. If students do this honestly, they don't just get better at jiu-jitsu, they rebuild themselves as stronger people. They learn how to be tougher, smarter, more resilient, not just in a fight, but also in everyday life. I was around 17 when I met Sergio Zaveter at the academy downtown and began to teach him privately. He was 20 or 21 and had just graduated from law school, but I knew even then that he would go far in law or maybe politics. We became good friends and would often go out to eat after class and surf together. Because we were both very accomplished in our own fields, we had a great deal of mutual respect that grew into a deep bond, and Sergio later became my most trusted advisor. It was not just his sharp mind that I liked. He was also a very straight shooter. If I had a question, I would always ask him what he thought, because I knew that he would always give me his honest opinion, whether I liked it or not. By 17, I was a full jiu-jitsu instructor and made more money than a bank manager. If I was not training, I was spending my time at the beach in Ipanema with the surfers. Unlike my gangster friends, who were much more intense and interested only in fucking and fighting, the surfers were hippies and lovers. Our lives were centered on the waves and beach. The sea has always been a great normalizer for me. If I'm tense and I go into the ocean, I come out relaxed. If I'm lazy and tired and I go in, I come away energized. The ocean either gives me the extra energy that I need or takes away the excess energy that I don't. Rivers and waterfalls do similar things for me. When I was a kid, I liked to stay in the ocean until I was freezing cold, then go on the beach and roll in the hot sand to warm up. First I rode inflatable surf mats, then styrofoam boards, and eventually moved up to real surfboards. I realized that the sea was a place where I could test myself and push my limits. The ocean is too strong to fight. You have to flow with it, remain calm, and navigate your way in and out of incredibly complex situations. One day around this time, I was at the beach checking the surf on a stormy day. Nobody was around because it was windy and out of control. Then I noticed a skinny kid with long hair at the water's edge with a red surfboard. It turned out that it was my brother Holz's friend Pepe, who was one of Brazil's first big wave riders. I sat down and watched him paddle out into the violent sea and then surf with a kind of casual grace and mastery that I had never seen before. Pepe was a little older than me, but not by much. If he could surf like this, then so could I. I was now on a mission to get my black belt in surfing. Surfing was a new sport in Brazil, so it was a big deal when the first professional surfing contest came to Rio in 1977. My brothers and I all surfed and were excited to see our Hawaiian, Australian, and Californian idols. My friend Foca was surfing our local beach, and he collided with a Hawaiian pro surfer named Byron Amona, who was a member of the infamous Hawaiian surf gang, the Black Shorts. They ruled Oahu's North Shore and were nasty to outsiders, especially Brazilians. The big Hawaiian grabbed Foca's board, punched the fins out, and kicked him out of the water at his home beach. Can you imagine the humiliation? I was at Ipanema Beach right after it happened, and Foca showed up with his broken board and told us that the big Hawaiian had punched out his fins and kicked him out of the water. We went to find Amona, but he had already left. That night, I told my dad and brothers what had happened at the beach, and everyone agreed that Amona needed to be put in his place. The Hawaiian needed to know that the rules were different here in Brazil. A day or so later, we found out that Byron Amona and some other Hawaiian and American pro surfers were at the home and surfboard factory of Brazil's first pro surfer, Kiko de Sousa. Everyone in Rio knew that the Gracies drove Volkswagens, so when the Brazilian surfboard factory workers saw a fleet of VWs pull up and us pile out, they ran for their lives. One guy even jumped out of a window. My brother Helson came, but most of the other 20 with us were surfers. Everyone waited outside while I went inside Hiko's factory to find Byron Amona. When I saw Byron's Dick Brewer surfboard, I told a friend to grab it and take it outside. I found Hiko in the shaping room talking with one of the Americans, and I told him that we had a problem that needed to be resolved. This motherfucker Byron broke Foca's board and now needs to pay for it one way or another. Once Hiko sensed that I was in fighting mode, he said, "Please, let's go outside," and tried to usher us out of the house. When Hiko saw the crowd outside, he knew where this was going and said, "Please, Hickson, don't destroy my business." I told Hiko that if he wanted to kiss the Hawaiians' asses and let them act like assholes in his own hometown, he could fight too. Hiko tried to de-escalate the situation, but he was stuck between a rock and a hard place. As I was walking back outside, I peeked into the side yard and saw pro surfers Mike Purpose, Michael Ho, and Byron Amona smoking a joint. They looked at me, laughed, and flashed me Shaka hand signs with their fingers. I didn't smile back and stared at Amona instead. 30 seconds later, the Hawaiian was outside screaming, "Where's my board? Where's my board?" Everyone got quiet, and then I said in Portuguese, "Your board is with me." He looked at me with contempt. There was more silence, which I broke with the only English phrases I knew. "Fuck you, motherfucker. I'm going to break your face." The Hawaiian didn't take me seriously, because I was a 150-pound 18-year-old, and he was over 250 pounds. Byron realized that I had just challenged him to fight, and he began to loosen up his arms and legs like a kickboxer. He turned to Hiko and said, "I'm going to hurt this kid." I shot in, got him in a clinch, tripped him, and took him down. Amona tried to stand up, but I took his back, choked him out, and he fell on his face unconscious. I punched him back to his senses, and when he tried to stand up again, I got his back and started to choke him out for the second time. Amona was really strong, so I couldn't finish the choke and headbutted him instead. "Put this motherfucker to sleep," Helson yelled, as Hiko begged, "Please, don't kill him." After I put Byron to sleep for the second time, I grabbed a piece of concrete and smashed his board with it. It only seemed fair, given what he had done to Foca. Word of the fight spread quickly. The next day, some of the Australian pro surfers came up to me at the beach and said, "Fuck, you're the guy who beat Byron. I wish I knew your techniques." They congratulated me and were happy because the Black Shorts gang and Amona made their lives miserable in Hawaii. A few days later, I saw Byron Amona at the opening ceremony of the Waimea 5000 surf contest, drinking beer with his friends. He started yelling and got very aggressive. His friends held him back as he screamed, "I'm going to find you and kick your ass." After that, Amona started telling people that he was going to find me and get me before he returned to Hawaii. When I told my dad about these threats, he said that we would pay the Hawaiian a visit at his hotel. The next day, my dad, Horion, and I went to the Sheraton Hotel at Leblon. The hotel has its own private beach, so I waited there while Horion, the only one of us who spoke English, went inside. He found Byron by the swimming pool, introduced himself, and told him that I was waiting for him on the beach. "You either fight Hickson now or forget the matter," Horion explained. "You said that you were going to find him, and that is not acceptable." Byron told my brother that he didn't want to fight again, and that the matter was resolved. The Hawaiian went home a few days later with a better understanding of Brazil. I'd like to think we were his unofficial cultural ambassadors. Such an easy win against such an intimidating guy gave me a great deal of confidence, perhaps even overconfidence. After that fight, the best surfers in Rio began to show me respect, and even the girls took notice. I was often frustrated in Ipanema because the beautiful beach girls my age usually dated rich guys with convertibles. That would soon change. It was around this time that I began to realize that my father and uncle were frozen in time. Everything from their relationships with the women in their lives to their views on procreation seemed out of touch. How the fuck was I supposed to have sex only for procreation and never masturbate? You have to realize that sex in Brazil is much freer and more natural than in the United States. The weather is hot and humid. People wear very few clothes, and we are impulsive, sensual people who like to be in close contact to each other. The sweat, the physical intimacy, the sensations. Brazilians need this proximity and bodily engagement to feel comfortable. For many Brazilians, sex is like eating. It is just a human need. My father and uncles had a different view of this, as evidenced by their legacy of children, but I wanted the enjoyable aspects of sex as well. I wanted the passion and fun. Drugs were plentiful in Rio when I was growing up. No matter what experiences I had with drugs, I always felt that I had a strong base. I was loved and protected at home, which left me free to dream, venture out into the world, and find my place in it. If my dad had said, "Don't do that. That is wrong," my story would be a very different one. As Gracies, we were all taught the protocols on fighting, diet, and training, but it was our decision to follow them or not. The lack of pressure, ironically, made me feel more grounded. Surfers liked marijuana and hallucinogens like magic mushrooms. We used to go to the cow pastures to pick the golden mushrooms that grew in the cow shed. We would eat the foul-tasting fungus with lime and then go to the beach, paddle out into the surf, and wait for the trip to start. I remember one day when the waves were small but perfect. As the mushrooms came on, I felt like I could see the atoms in the water. Then I felt like an amphibious creature who could stay underwater for as long as I wanted. After I got out of the sea, I walked to a rocky area, and my feet felt like part of the rock. I stayed planted there for hours. This experience forced me to look outside of myself and to marvel at the beauty of the natural world. By the time I was 17, Rio's nightlife was playing a bigger role in my life. Typically, a night out would consist of visiting different nightclubs and not getting home until after sunrise. Sometimes we would just walk around and listen for music. If we heard a party, we'd figure out which apartment it was in and crash it. We drank whiskey like the cowboys in movies, and Rio, so close to Peru, was awash in pure cocaine. Because I was not exactly square, I certainly tried it. But my family support system made it hard to go too far astray, because I knew that the next day, tired or not, I would be teaching and training. Some of my friends who didn't have this type of support had begun to slip. One night I would see them at the club, and a month later I'd see them staggering around the street barefoot. "Fuck, man, what happened to your front teeth? Where's your motorcycle?" I'd ask. "I don't know, man. The last thing I remember is the night we were doing lines with those beautiful girls at the club." Sometimes after a big night out, I'd feel I'd gone too far, but come the next day, I would eat well, run, surf, and train. I'd be good for a week or two, and then a voice in my head would direct me off path. "The night, the girls, they're waiting for you." Even though drugs were more dangerous for my friends who were not athletes, I would learn that drug addiction can strike anyone. 5 years younger than me, Marcelo Bering was one of my best friends and best students. He was born into jiu-jitsu royalty. His father, Flavio, was my dad's student and also an instructor. Marcelo grew up on the mat, and when he was 14, he started coming to my school to train with me. We immediately connected, and over time he became like another younger brother. Because Marcelo had been training since he was a little kid, I refined and built upon his existing knowledge. As he started to perfect his connections and other invisible aspects of jiu-jitsu, he went from a good blue belt to one of my best students. Marcelo always competed under my flag, and I was always in his corner, pushing him to get better and better. As a brown belt, he fought and won an important Vale Tudo match and gained a great deal of respect. When I was in his corner, he could do anything. When Marcelo was training with me in Brazil, he partied occasionally, maybe 5% of the time, but his main priority was training and fighting. After I left Brazil to pursue my own fighting career, he lost his direction and began partying 25% of the time. After he signed a contract for a professional fight and didn't show up, I think he felt ashamed and his downward spiral began. Every time we spoke, I tried to draw Marcelo toward the light and get him back to fighting and training. His family even put him in rehab, but he left early and could not break the grip of his cocaine addiction. I got really worried about him when one of our mutual friends told me that they had seen him walking around Rio at 4 a.m. in swim trunks. Shortly thereafter, he vanished, and his family didn't hear from him for 3 months. The Berings hired a private investigator who eventually found Marcelo's body in a pauper's grave. It was suspected that he was killed in a favela in a drug deal gone wrong. For some, the grip of addiction is too strong to break. If I were to be the greatest Gracie, I had to take risks. Even though I experimented with different drugs and potentially dangerous lifestyles, I valued my freedom above all. I never wanted to be controlled by anything, especially a drug. I also realized that I had a God-given talent for jiu-jitsu, and with this came the honor and responsibility to represent my family. This always brought me back to a place of equilibrium. It was always fun to leave reality for a night, but no matter what, I was back in the academy training the next day. I never knew who might walk through the door and challenge me, and becoming the greatest Gracie was more important to me than anything else. Curiosity coupled with courage allows you to go beyond your limits, venture into the unknown, and establish new limits that you never thought were possible. My curiosity always overpowered my fear, but fear was also a good friend to me. People who say they are not afraid of anything are either crazy or stupid. Fear is a normal emotion that protects you, but sometimes you don't need protection. There are times when you have to place fear on the shelf and take action without a moment's hesitation. One such time occurred one evening when I was out alone surfing Saquarema, one of Brazil's best big wave breaks. The sun was starting to set, but I decided to catch one more wave. As I was paddling back out, a cleanup set broke on my head, my leash broke, and I never saw my surfboard again. The current started to pull me out to sea. When I realized that it was too strong to swim against, a jolt of adrenaline snapped me to my senses. I knew that if I panicked or made a mistake, I would die. In order to get out of the current, I had to swim parallel to shore at a pace that would allow me to swim for hours if necessary. I used the lights from a church way down the coast as a visual bearing and focused on my stroke and my breathing. 2 hours later, when I stumbled onto dry land, I wasn't just happy to get back in. I was proud of myself because I had used my brain and my endurance to save my own life. Winning fights, riding wild horses, or taming vicious dogs, none of it compared to this. That swim was by far the most terrifying experience of my life, because nature was working against me. Luck did not get me back to shore. I faced down primal fear and prevailed. The next day, I made myself go back to Saquarema, paddle out, and catch a few waves. I eventually learned that the capacity to accept anything, especially death, was the key to my physical, mental, and spiritual growth. All three of these elements must be balanced, because sometimes you don't break physically, but emotionally. Sometimes you have the physicality and the emotional control, but are spiritually unprepared. Without a spiritual connection to both life and death, you can't reach the next level of performance. Soon I would realize that if I were to dance on the razor's edge, I might fall off it and die. That was the price of admission. By the time I was a brown belt, my matches with my brother Holes were getting closer. I was beginning to understand the limitations of his game. Holes had an excellent neon belly move that he used to set up arm locks, and he was lethal if he got your back, but he was also predictably aggressive. In our final 10 training sessions, not only did Holes not submit me, but I was getting reversals, and our fights were now even. One afternoon, we were training together by ourselves at my dad's ranch in Petropolis. The only thing I remember is engaging with Holes, then going through the eye of a hurricane with all the violence you would expect. When the storm passed, I had rolls in a choke, and before I even realized what was happening, he was tapping. It was a completely reactive fight. I'm not even sure if I was mounted or on his back. All I remember is that I finished him with a choke. Nobody else saw me beat Holes, and when we finished training, we hugged and he kissed me on the cheek and said, "You did good, kid. I'm proud of you." What I remember most about that fight was the sadness I felt afterward, as though I had made a mistake by beating him. A huge but invisible weight of responsibility had shifted from Holes's shoulders to mine. In my heart, I knew that I was now a better fighter, but worse, so did he. It wasn't luck or a fluke. Holes just couldn't surprise me anymore. I also realized that I would never have to beat him again to prove it. But things were different in public. When Holes and I faced each other in open division finals of tournaments and the referee signaled the start of the match, I would walk across the mat and raise his hand in the air. Holes would always take first, and I would take second. He and I knew that I was the best, but to the rest of the universe, Holes was still the champion. I didn't need to announce to the world that I had defeated my brother. I didn't want to break his spirit and put myself above him. Keeping this secret was a way for me to honor him and my family. By the time I got my black belt a few months after beating Holes, he and I were going in completely different directions. My brother was putting all of his energy into competitive grappling in an effort to establish a Brazilian national wrestling team. American wrestler Bob Anderson, who had stayed with him in Rio, helped him navigate the international bureaucracy and got us invited to the 1979 World Sambo Championships in San Diego. Invented in Russia, Sambo is a competitive grappling style that includes knee, ankle, and leg attacks. However, many of my favorite jiu-jitsu submissions are not allowed. My dad paid for me, Holes, and Carlos Jr. to go to America to compete in 3 different weight divisions. When the competition began, we started to submit everyone with footlocks. The referees got mad because we were going only for submissions, not throws or points, so they began to stop our fights before we could submit our opponents. Once, Holes caught one guy in a footlock, and the referee stopped the match and said, "You can't grab the joint, only the shin." Every time Holes got near a foot, they stopped the match, so he ended up getting only 3rd in his division. Carlos Jr. made the finals and lost. I made the finals and faced a strong wrestler from the U.S. Air Force. He got on top of me, and I couldn't sweep him because his base was excellent. He was up 15-0 with only 1 minute left when I finally swept him and mounted. He tried to push me off, and I armlocked him. He screamed in pain, and the referee stopped the fight. I won my division. Even though I won the gold medal, I thought the tournament was bullshit. I was only allowed to use straight arm bars, footlocks, and knee bars, and even those were subject to a bunch of rules and subjective referee decisions. Wrestling was even worse than Sambo when it came to arbitrary rules and biased referees. Holes, Carlos Jr., some of our students, and I represented Rio in some of the Brazilian national wrestling tournaments, and there was always some crooked shit going on. I went to weigh in for the Brazilian championships that were held at the police gymnasium in Rio. A European-looking guy from Minas Gerais they called Salty was in charge, and I was 2 ounces overweight. When Holes asked for 15 minutes for me to cut the weight, Salty slammed his notebook shut and said, "No, he's disqualified." The referee during the championship match was from Minas Gerais, and he was clearly throwing the match in favor of his fighter. After one especially bad call, my cousin Hobson ran onto the mat and slapped the referee in the face. This started a big brawl between our team and the Minas Gerais team. Salty was in the center of the chaos, and I was still pissed off that he had disqualified me, so I punched him in the face. Down he went, just like that. Very quickly, the Minas Gerais team was losing the brawl badly. We chased them out of the gym and down the street, all of us still in our wrestling singlets. Later, we were sued by the wrestling commission, but fortunately, one of Holes's friends filmed everything. After he gave the footage to the sports council, they reviewed it, awarded us the judgment, and dismissed all the cases. In addition to the arbitrary rules, there was another reason why I was losing all interest in wrestling and Sambo. Both sports forced me to reinvent myself as a much more physical fighter who relied on strength and speed rather than intelligence or technique. While Holes continued to wrestle and tried to establish a Brazilian national team, I was moving toward Vale Tudo because there was little left for me to prove in jiu-jitsu. I was growing so dominant in jiu-jitsu competition that when I stepped onto the mat and the referee said go, the crowd began to count out loud, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6. If I didn't submit my opponent in 10 seconds, they would start counting again. Even as a black belt, my only jiu-jitsu fight that went more than 5 minutes came after the judges robbed my brother Hoyler of a win against one of my cousin Carlson's students. My final match in the open class was against Carlson's 240-pound heavyweight. I was so upset that I decided that I wanted to make him suffer. After I got him down, I mounted and just put unbearable pressure on him. I was not fighting my actual opponent. Instead, I was trying to punish Carlson for robbing Hoyler. Everything I was doing was fueled by ego and anger, and I was working against myself because my emotions were negating all of my precision and my martial artistry. I was spinning my wheels as if I were on ice and was going nowhere. I was just blindly punishing him until Holes yelled, 8 minutes are up. I was shocked because that was too long. I snapped to my senses, got mad at myself, and easily submitted him. Afterward, I realized that I never wanted to fight like this again because I was putting emotion before reason. Although nobody else realized it at the time, I learned an important lesson that day, that it was a mistake to fight emotionally because emotions blinded me. For me, jiu-jitsu needed to be more like chess, staying many moves ahead of my opponents and using my functional intelligence to take advantage of any windows of opportunity. Rarely are both fighters comfortable in a fight. Almost always, one is applying pressure and one is under pressure. If you are uncomfortable, you are losing. If I am uncomfortable, even for a few seconds, I make the necessary adjustments and get comfortable again. Once I'm comfortable, I'm your worst nightmare. I never knew exactly what an opponent was going to do, but I didn't need to. Once the engagement began, my goal was to use pain and discomfort to force an error, and then checkmate my opponent with a clean submission. As a fighter, despite my progress, I still had homework to do. Now I wanted to use all of the tools I had available in a valetudo fight. I would soon learn that the difference between a jiu-jitsu match and a valetudo fight was like the difference between kart racing and Formula One. Chapter 4. The Unfettered Mind. I happened to be standing next to my dad when his one-time nemesis, Valdemar the Black Panther Santana, called him on the phone in 1980. By now, almost 30 years after their legendary three-hour fight, they were friends again and could laugh about it. My dad listened to Valdemar for a while, nodding the entire time, and then turned to me and said, "Valdemar says he has a guy in the north no one can beat. He wants to know if I have a fighter who is up for it. He wants to promote a big event." "Dad, let me do it. Let me do it," I begged. Impressed by my enthusiasm, Elio spoke into the receiver. "Valdemar, I have a boy here who has never done anything, but I'll take a chance and do the business right. He is my son." My life at the time was simple. I was 19 and still living with my parents in the apartment where I grew up. I trained hard every day, made plenty of money teaching, and surfed whenever there were waves. There were big changes on my horizon, though, because in addition to committing to my first professional fight, I had fallen deeply in love. I had first seen Kim Slavik at the beach and had been struck by her beauty. And besides being a model of physical perfection, she was also an independent woman who was a successful model, a pro surfer, and a pro hang glider. We knew each other by reputation, but the first time we spoke eye to eye and face to face was at a concert at Sugarloaf Mountain. We spent the night together dancing, and there was a strong connection between us. Kim said that she felt as though we had known each other in a past life. Although she was spending more and more nights at my apartment, we also gave each other a great deal of freedom, because she was as active as I was. Kim would soon see another side of me in my first professional valetudo fight against a massive and terrifying African-Brazilian named Casemiro Nascimento Martins, who fought under the stage name King Zulu. He was 33, stood 6'4", weighed 230 pounds, and supposedly had not lost since 1963. He was not part of a team, an academy, or even an established martial art. He was a dangerous, unorthodox fighter, who combined fighting with capoeira footwork and grappling. King Zulu also used to like to make faces at his opponents and mock them in the ring. When my Uncle Carlos learned the date of the King Zulu fight, he freaked out and said, "Hickson's emotional, intellectual, and physical biorhythms will be at all-time lows. If I were you, I would postpone the fight." I told my dad that I didn't care about biorhythms or about winning or even losing. I just wanted to test myself. I had been waiting to become a fighter my entire life. No way was I going to back out now. A month before my fight, my dad and I traveled to Brasilia to watch King Zulu fight another giant called Paulo, who made Zulu look small. Because valetudo fighting had been illegal in Rio for many years, I had never been to an actual valetudo fight. The crowd in Brasilia was hostile and aggressive, just as I imagine it would have been in the Roman Colosseum. On the sidelines, bookies were giving odds, and spectators were screaming praise and insults at the fighters. There was no pretense of sportsmanship. It was pure madness. When the fight began, Sulu lifted Paulu all the way over his head and threw him onto the canvas, his trademark move, more reliant on brute strength than technique. The fight ended after King Sulu poked Paulu so hard in the eye that he couldn't continue. Between the raucous crowd and the brutality of the fight, the experience intimidated me. I hoped that Sulu wouldn't throw me on my head, but I figured I was smart enough to avoid it. When I got back to Rio, I trained with the strongest guys I could find and always started in bad positions like chokes, arm locks, or while mounted. The more uncomfortable, the better. 1 month later, my father, Holes, and I returned to Brasilia for the fight. They would be my corner men. On the day of my fight,